Okay, theology proper, lecture number three. Now remember, the first two lectures we talked about different worldviews that contradict Christianity. Looks like they stole our chalk here. Maybe they don't want us chalking up the thing. Yeah, if you find any, Jeff, that'd be great. If not, no biggie. Okay, but the worldviews, different non-theistic worldviews, we discussed that already. And then we started discussing the theistic arguments. What I'm going to do right now is read from Romans 1. Romans chapter 1. We've already discussed the ontological and the moral and the teleological argument. And now we're going to begin to discuss the cosmological argument. But in Romans chapter 1, it gives us the basic justification, biblical justification for arguing through God's existence. Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 22. And that reads, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks. But they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools." But Romans 1, verses 18 and 22, it says that we have not seen the invisible God, but we do see the visible work of His hands. Therefore, the invisible God has proven His existence to mankind through His visible creation. So a man is without excuse if he denies the existence of the true God of the Bible. It doesn't mean you can get saved just by looking at creation, but God proves His existence and His power to us through creation. Romans 2, 14 and 15, Paul says that God has written His laws on the conscience of each person. So that even if we never had God's laws written in the Bible, we know right from wrong, and when we sin, we get a guilty conscience. And so God's written His laws in our hearts. Psalm 19:1, King David says the heavens declare the glory of God and the skies proclaim the work of His hands. So from creation we can find evidence for the existence of the God of the Bible. So what I want to do right now is look at some cosmological arguments for God's existence. First, the three different types. Remember, the teleological argument argues that the universe is a product of intelligent design, therefore it must have an intelligent designer. That's the teleological argument. The moral argument argues that the universal moral law, which is above all men, implies the existence of a universal moral lawgiver who is above all men. And then the ontological argument argues that pretty much that God by definition must exist. But the cosmological argument, very important, you will see all these arguments just on the test, probably in the matching. But the cosmological argument is the argument from cause and effect. It argues that the universe is an effect that needs a cause. And therefore, God must have, Christians call the cause of the universe God. Now, I wish I had chalk, but since we don't, we're going to have to go without writing on the board. Basically, there's three different types of cosmological arguments. Three different types. There's the Leibniz type cosmological argument for God's existence. He lived from 1646 to 1716. The dates are not important for purposes of the test. But Leibniz, L-E-I-B-N-I-Z, Leibniz, the type of cosmological argument that he used is called the cosmological argument from the principle of sufficient reason. So remember, Leibniz and sufficient reason. Leibniz, L-E-I-B-N-I-Z. And his cosmological argument was from sufficient reason. And he argues that there's a sufficient reason for everything that exists. There's a sufficient reason for everything that exists. Leibniz argues that the existence of some beings is explained by something other than itself. So there's a sufficient reason for everything that exists, and the existence of some beings is explained by something other than itself. For instance, my existence is explained by my parents, the air that I breathe, the food that I eat, the water that I drink. All these things need to be entered into the equation to explain my existence. Now, Leibniz says that the collection of all these beings needs an explanation. In other words, if each one of these beings needs and is explained by something other than itself, then when you collect all these together, this collection itself, collection of all these contingent beings or beings that are explained by something other than themselves, that itself, that collection needs an explanation. Leibniz then argues, by the way, you don't have to get all these factors down. That would be a philosophy of religion course. So I'm just going to read this to you. An infinite regress of sufficient reasons is impossible, because then there would be no ultimate explanation at all. Therefore, there must exist a being who contains within itself the reason for its own existence. He's not saying it's a self-caused being, but Leibniz would say a self-explained being. This being explains the existence of itself and all other beings. In other words, Leibniz would say, well, I really wish I had to be able to write on the board, Leibniz would say that the self-explained being is a being that explains its own existence, such as God being uncaused, such as God having no beginning and no end. God would be his own explanation. In other words, the explanation of God is I am that I am. That's the reason for his existence, is he exists, period. He has no beginning and no end. God is existence. Yeah.
You would say he explains
his existence as a necessity. Yeah. He has necessary existence. He cannot not exist. He must exist. He is existence. Whereas any being that exists, which its existence must be explained by other beings, is a contingent existence or dependent existence. Whereas a necessary independent existence, it is its own reason for its existence. It's not saying it's self-caused. That would be a contradiction in terms, because something would have to exist before it existed in order to bring its own existence about. That'd be self-causation. But a self-explained being is an uncaused being. And so that's the Leibniz argument. Just remember, Leibniz, the type of cosmological argument he gave was sufficient reason, that the universe needs a reason for its existence, and God is the reason why the universe exists. Now, very closely related to that is the Thomistic cosmological argument of existential causality. Just remember, Aquinas, A-Q-U-I-N-A-S, Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas, who lived from 1224 to 1274 A.D., his cosmological argument was based on the principle of existential causality. So Aquinas argued for the cause of the universe, whereas Leibniz argued for the sufficient reason or explanation of the universe. But Aquinas argued that beings exist which are dependent on other beings for their continuing existence. Now, this is real important. The principle of existential causality, Thomas Aquinas is not arguing for the cause of the beginning of the universe. That's a different type of argument, an argument that St. Bonaventure used. He got it from the Muslim philosophers. That's called the Kalam cosmological argument. We'll get there in a minute. Aquinas isn't arguing for the beginning of the universe. He's arguing for the current cause of it continuing in existence. For instance, Aquinas is not arguing for the start of the universe. He's arguing for God not as the creator of the universe, but as the sustainer of the universe. In other words, God keeps us in existence. And so Aquinas would argue that beings exist which are dependent on other beings for their continuing existence. Now, you don't have to jot all this down, but just listen closely. Dependent beings cannot be the ultimate cause of the continuing existence of other dependent beings, because adding dependent beings never gives us an independent being. Therefore, the ultimate cause for the continuing existence of all dependent beings must itself be an independent being. In other words, no matter how much dependent existence that you add together or contingent existence that you add together, it will never give you an independent being. You need an independent, necessary being, non-contingent being, to cause the cause the continuing existence of all continued beings. Aquinas is kind of arguing it's like your reflection in a mirror. The cause and the effect are existing simultaneously. So if you remove your face from in front of that mirror, the effect will be gone simultaneously. But the key to remember with Aquinas in this argument here is Aquinas is arguing from the principle, the cosmological argument he uses is from existential causality. It's for the continuing existence of something. And then St. Bonaventure, who lived from 1221, St. Bonaventure lived from 1221 to 1274, and he used the Kalam cosmological argument, which argues for the beginning of the universe. This is a very simple argument, but to defend the premises is pretty difficult, but I like this, and Aquinas is the best. But this argument states, by the way, Norman Geisler, Leibniz's principle for sufficient reason, say that God is self-explained, Geisler finds that to be, equates that with being a self-caused being. And I think in his philosophy of religion, so he thinks that Leibniz's argument doesn't hold water. I disagree.
He sees it as circular reasoning, petition of productivity.
Yeah, kind of in that God would have to, he sees it as being synonymous with self-cause, which is a self-refuting statement. But the problem there is he equates reason or explanation with cause there, but then he also argues that it's not a good argument because an explanation exists in the mind, a cause must exist outside the mind. So there, he says they're synonymous, and that's why it folds, but then they're not synonymous, and that's why it folds. You can't have it both ways. So in his philosophy of religion, I disagree with Geisler's assessment there. Anyway, St. Bonaventure, using the Kalam cosmological argument, Kalam is K-A-L-A-M, and the Kalam argument argues for the beginning of the universe. It just argues whatever had a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. The infinite regress of cause and effects is impossible, therefore the ultimate cause of the universe must be eternal. All you need to remember about these three types of arguments is that the Aquinas used the cosmological argument from existential causality, and he was looking at the cause of the sustaining, the cause of the continuing existence of the universe. Leibniz used the argument, cosmological argument from sufficient reason, and he was looking for the explanation for why the universe existed, whereas Bonaventure used the Kalam cosmological argument. He was looking for the beginning of the existence of the universe. Just different types of cosmological arguments. Now, what I want to do before we move on to the problem the problem with evil. I just want to read to you from my opening statement when I debated Dr. Peter John at Lower Columbia College on the question, does God exist? I just want to read to you the Thomistic argument from existential causality and the Kalam cosmological argument part of that argument, the Bonaventure type argument. And what I've done though is I've taken these cosmological arguments and I've added to them teleological and moral argument principles. In other words, once I argued for God as the cause of the universe, then I argued for God, the cause must be an infinite, intelligent being and moral being as well. So the Thomistic argument from existential causality, it's kind of combined Aquinas' five ways to prove that God exists. Experience shows us that you don't need to take notes on this. Experience shows us that limited dependent beings exist. These limited dependent beings need other beings for their continued existence. For example, I depend on air, water, and food to sustain my existence. However, adding limited dependent beings will never give us an independent and unlimited whole. Therefore, the sum total of limited dependent beings is itself limited and dependent. Hence, the ultimate cause of the continuing existence of all limited dependent beings must be unlimited and independent. There cannot be two or more unlimited and independent beings, since if there were, they would limit one another's existence. But then they would not be unlimited. Therefore, there can only be one unlimited and independent being. This being must have all its attributes in an unlimited way. Otherwise, it could not be an unlimited being. This being must be all-powerful, for he is the source of all the power in the universe. No other power can limit him. He is eternal, for he is not limited by time. He is everywhere present, since he is not limited by space. He is immaterial, since he is not limited by matter. This being must also be all good, since he is not limited by evil. He must also be unlimited in knowledge. Since mindless nature works towards goals, such as acorns always becoming oak trees and not something else, there must be an intelligent designer overseeing natural processes. Without intelligent design, nature's processes would be left to chance. There would be no orderly patterns that could be described as natural laws. Therefore, this infinite and independent being that all finite and dependent existence depends upon for its continued existence must be an intelligent being. By the way, lucky too, all the first few lectures are real philosophical, but then we start getting into the Bible once we get the basis for the God of the Bible, so it's going to be a lot less philosophical when we get to those arguments there, or when we get to those sections of this course. And that was the Thomistic argument based on existential causality, combining it with moral and teleological arguments. With the Kalam cosmological argument, it's going to take just a little bit longer to read. I'm not going to read it word for word. If I could summarize things, I'm going to do that as best as I could. Kalam cosmological argument of Bonaventure. Whatever began to exist must have a cause, for from nothing, nothing comes. Since the universe began to exist, it must have a cause. There is much evidence for the beginning of the universe. Scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe includes the second law of thermodynamics, which is called energy deterioration, and also the Big Bang model. I place much more weight in the second law of thermodynamics because the Big Bang model is only a model and it's been called into question over and over again. The second law of thermodynamics is one of the most firmly established laws of modern science. It states that the amount of usable energy in a closed system is running down. This means that someday in the finite future, all the energy in the universe will be useless. In other words, if left to itself, the universe will have an end. But if the universe is going to have an end, it had to have a beginning. At one time in the finite past, all the energy in the universe was usable. If the universe is winding down, then it must have originally been wound up. The universe is therefore not eternal. It had a beginning. Since it had a beginning, it needs a cause, for from nothing, nothing comes. The Big Bang model also teaches us that the universe had a beginning. In 1929, astronomer Edwin Hubble discovered that the universe is expanding at the same rate in all directions. As time moves forward, the universe is growing apart. But this means that if we go back in time, the universe will be getting smaller and smaller. Eventually, if we go back far enough in the past, the entire universe would be what scientists call a point of infinite density. This marks the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang. There have been two main attempts to refute the beginning of the universe. The first is the steady state model. This view holds that the universe never had a beginning. Instead, it always existed in the same state. But the mounting evidence for the Big Bang model, this view has been abandoned by most of its adherents. The second attempt to evade the beginning of the universe is called the oscillating model. This model teaches that at some point during the universe's expansion, gravity will halt the expansion and pull everything back together again. From that point, there will be another Big Bang. This process will be repeated over and over again throughout all eternity. Unfortunately, the oscillating model fails. First, there is no known principle of physics that would reverse the expansion of the universe into another Big Bang. Second, current scientific research has shown that the universe is not dense enough for gravity to pull it back together again. And third, even if it could be proven that several Big Bangs have occurred, the second law of thermodynamics would still require that there was a first Big Bang. Besides the scientific evidence, there is also philosophical evidence for the beginning of the universe. For if the universe is eternal, there would be an infinite number of events in time. I'm not going to bring up Zeno's paradox. This isn't a philosophy course. But I'll just basically say that it can be thrown through infinite set theory in math and through Zeno's paradox that it's impossible to have an actual infinite set of things that exist outside the mind, because that would generate contradictions. And so there cannot be an infinite number of moments existing outside the mind. Therefore, there had to be a first event. Let me see if I can pick it up on this chat and in this paragraph, see if it makes sense. Since the universe had to have a beginning, it had to have a cause, for from nothing, nothing comes. But if the universe needs a cause, what if the cause of the universe also needs a cause? Could we not have an infinite chain of causes and effects stretching backwards in time throughout all eternity? Obviously, the answer is no, for we have already shown that an actual infinite set is impossible, existing outside the mind. I don't want to get too deep here, but the only place an actual infinite set could exist would be inside an infinite mind, because you would have an actual infinite number of data, and you couldn't get there through addition, because you can't traverse an actual infinite set. Zeno's paradoxes prove that possibility false. So the only way this infinite mind could know an actual infinite number of things would be in one eternal thought, rather than learning it, you know, one thought at a time. But basically, though, what I'd be arguing for here, though, is if there was an actual infinite, for the universe to be eternal, there would have to be an actual infinite number of moments before you even reach the moment of creation. But since you can't traverse, you can't cross an actual infinite set of moments, you would never reach the moment of creation, but the moment of creation has been reached. So Zeno's paradox, to get from this chair to that table, to get from point A to point B, first you would have to get halfway. Okay? Assuming there's an infinite number of points between the two, okay? First, you'd have to get halfway, but before you get from point A to the halfway point, you would have to get halfway. But before you can get from that point A to that halfway point, you'd have to get halfway. In other words, movement never gets started assuming there's an infinite set of points between the two. So Plato is showing it's impossible to traverse or cross an actual infinite set. In fact, if actual infinite sets existed outside the mind, you would have like the set of all odd and even numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, on and on infinitely, that's an infinite set. But if you took half of that set, just the even numbers, 2, 4, 6, 8, on, they would both be equal because they're both infinite, but the set of just the even numbers would also be half the size of the other set. So how could it be both equal in number, because they're both infinite, but only half the size? That generates contradictions. It can't exist in the real world. And so what that tells us, there had to be a first event. And so the universe, both philosophically and scientifically, had a first event. There was a moment of creation, and that moment of creation, therefore, since the universe had a beginning, it had to have a cause. Now, once we establish that the universe had a cause for its existence, then I go further to argue that the universe, during that debate, I argued that the cause of the universe must be an intelligent being. This debate, hopefully, is evidence that intelligent life exists in the universe. Since intelligence is found in the universe, the ultimate cause of the universe must also be an intelligent being. For intelligence cannot come from non-intelligence. You don't get intelligence from a rock. You don't get intelligence from electricity. But you get intelligence from an intelligent mind. No one has ever shown how intelligence could have evolved from mindless nature. Morality also exists in the universe. For without morality, there could be no such thing as right and wrong. But the moral judgments we make show that we do believe that there is such a thing as right and wrong. But nature is non-moral. No one holds a rock morally responsible for tripping them. Since nature is non-moral, but morality exists in the universe, the cause of the universe must be a moral being. The moral law is not invented by individuals, for individuals judge the actions of others. If morality is relative, no one could call the actions of Adolf Hitler wrong. Nor could society be the cause of moral law, since societies often pass judgment on one another. Only an absolute moral lawgiver who is qualitatively above man can be the cause of a moral law that stands above man and judges his actions. Therefore, the uncaused cause of the universe must be an intelligent moral being. This means that God must be a personal being. Because persons are intelligent, have intelligence, and are moral beings. I don't know if we should... just Blaise Pascal, I'll just give you a... This is how I closed up that debate. I'll just throw that in just to show you a little bit of how you can use Blaise Pascal to argue for the existence of God. I closed up my argument for God's existence in that debate as follows. Each of us thirsts for something more. Life never fully satisfies. It is my belief that only the God of the Bible can fully satisfy man's deepest needs. What hope can an atheist offer mankind? Even if he could guarantee us 70 years of happiness, what good would that be when compared with the eternity of non-existence that follows? If there is no God who sits enthroned, then Hitler will not be punished for his evil deeds. Mother Teresa will not be rewarded for her generous works of charity. If there is no God, then a million years from now, what would it matter if you were a Hitler or a Mother Teresa? What difference would it make? Would life have any ultimate meaning if there is no God? If non-existence is what awaits us, can we really make sense of life? You live, and then you die. There are no eternal consequences. We all finish our journeys in total nothingness. But if there is a God, then there is hope. The God of the Bible guarantees the defeat of evil and the triumph of good. He guarantees that Hitler will get his punishment and Mother Teresa will get her reward. God gives life meaning, for how we live our lives on earth brings eternal consequences. Without God, meaningless existence is all we face. Therefore, I beseech you to examine the evidence that I have presented. I beseech you to choose God. For as the Christian thinker and scientist Blaise Pascal has said, if you choose God and you lose nothing. But if you choose God and he exists, you win eternity. Pascal also pointed out that if you choose against God and he does not exist, you gain nothing. But if you choose against God and he does exist, you lose everything. Basically, you have everything to gain and nothing to lose by wagering on God, and you have nothing to gain and everything to lose by wagering against God. Therefore, the wise man will choose God. All I'm getting at here, the points I'm getting at, is that there is extremely good evidence for the existence of the God of the Bible. An intelligent, moral being who is the cause of everything else that exists. There's extremely good evidence for his existence and very weak arguments against his existence, and therefore it is only reasonable to conclude that the God of the Bible does in fact exist. And so what we've covered so far, we've covered the different worldviews, and then we've given arguments for the theistic, the existence of the God of theism or the God of the Bible. And again, I want to cover one more time the definition that we gave for God. The definition of God was, God is the self-conscious personal being who is the uncaused cause of all else that exists and who transcends the whole creation. He's separate from the whole creation while being immanent in it, while being involved with it, sustains it in existence, can intervene. Now, having said that, the biggest objection, we don't have time to go through all the different arguments against God's existence. I think it's safe to say, though, the strongest argument against God's existence has probably been the problem of evil. And so if we can spend the remainder of this lecture refuting the argument from the existence of evil, the argument for atheism through the problem of evil, then I think we would pretty much show that there really is no solid argument against God's existence. The philosophy of religion course, I spent the most time refuting atheism and defending God's existence and dealing with the problem of evil. So if you want to follow up on that, you just order the cassettes on the philosophy of religion. Here's the argument from the existence of evil against the existence of God. I just write the problem of evil in your notes. Again, we don't have chalk, so I can't help you guys by writing on the board. Maybe I'll have to pick up some chalk. Or maybe they just don't want me writing on the board. I could just bring in my own board if I had to. Here's the way the problem of evil goes. I need you guys to jot this down word for word if you don't have it already. If you've had it in your former courses and you still got it in your notes, that's fine. Here's the problem of evil, the argument, the way it's based. Point number one, an all-good God would want to destroy evil. So an all-good God would want to destroy evil. That's point number one. By the way, if you fall behind on these notes, just raise your hand after I present the Christian response, the 10 points of that, and I'll just hand you my notes and you can jot them down. But point number one, an all-good God would want to destroy evil. Point number two, an all-powerful God is able to destroy evil. An all-good God would want to destroy evil. An all-powerful God is able to destroy evil. Point number three, premise number three, But evil is not destroyed. It still exists. Premise number three, but evil is not destroyed. It still exists. Conclusion, therefore, no all good and all powerful God exists. So the conclusion is no all good and all powerful God exists. So an all good God will want to destroy evil, an all powerful God is able to destroy evil, but evil is not destroyed, it still exists. Therefore, no all good and all powerful God exists. Now obviously the Christian not wants to argue that God is all good and all powerful. You get guys like Rabbi Harold Kushner try to say God's not all powerful, and you get some other people might try to say that God's not all good, but the God of the Bible is obviously all good and all powerful. So the Christian response is number one, and jot these down as well. Number one, point number one, the Christian response to the problem of evil, there's an unnecessary time limit placed on God. An unnecessary time limit placed on God. In other words, who's to say that God will not destroy evil or defeat evil in the future? In fact, the Bible teaches that God is in the process of defeating evil. Obviously, through the death, resurrection, and second coming of Christ, God's in the process of defeating evil. So point number one, there's an unnecessary time limit placed on God because God is in the process of defeating evil. Point number two, God created the possibility for evil, not evil itself. Some people might say, well, just the fact of everything that God, if God created everything and evil is something that exists, then therefore God created evil. Well, that's not the case. God did not create evil, He created the possibility for evil. The possibility for evil, by the way, is just called free will. Human and angelic free will. The angels have free will, humans have free will. So evil is a real thing that exists, but it exists as a privation or a corruption or perversion of something good. Okay? Evil is the taking a good straight line and making it crooked, perverting that which is good. So God didn't create evil, He created the possibility for evil. We call that free will. Point number three, God allows evil for the purpose of a greater good. God allows evil for the purpose of a greater good, i.e. human free will. Point number four, God's love cannot be forced on His creatures. Point number four, God's love cannot be forced on His creatures. You can't have a love relationship. Forced love is basically, we call it rape. It's not a love relationship. You love the person and you give them the freedom to love you in return or to reject your love. So God's love cannot be forced on His creatures. It necessitated that He gave man free will. But once God gives human free will, we might choose evil and evil come into the picture. Point number five, the Christian does not have to argue that this is the greatest possible world. The Christian does not have to argue that this is the greatest possible world. We can argue instead that this is the greatest possible way to achieve the greatest possible world. In fact, a Christian could argue that the greatest possible world is heaven. So this is not the greatest possible world. Instead, it is the greatest possible way to achieve the greatest possible world, which is heaven, which is where there will be no evil. There'll be eternal happiness, eternal joy, with Jesus and with the triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and all those who freely chose to spend eternity with Him. So point number six, it was man's free choice that brought evil and human suffering into the world. Man's free choice that brought evil and human suffering into the world. And of course, Satan's free choice and the demon's free choice brought it into the universe. And by universe there in that statement, I don't just mean the physical universe, but everything God created in the spiritual realm. Point number 7, God will use evil for good purposes. God will use evil for good purposes. Such as, if there was no such thing as evil, we wouldn't be able to love our enemies because everybody would be friends. If there was no such thing as evil, we wouldn't be able to have a thing called courage because there'd be nothing evil to fear. Okay? Isaiah 55, 8, 9 talks about, God's ways and His thoughts are as far above our ways and our thoughts as the heavens are above the earth. Isaiah 55, 8, 9. And so a lot of times it's just as a child who goes through surgery questions why his father and mother would allow him to go through such horrible pain, they don't realize that they're parents are using the evil of the pain of surgery for the purpose of a greater good, i.e. saving the life of the child. Point number 8, atheists usually deny the existence of evil. Atheists usually deny the existence of evil, but then they resurrect the existence of evil to try to disprove God's existence. I don't know if one of you guys wants to try to turn on that heat over there because it's kind of chilly in this room. I don't know if they got the air conditioning on or something. It's up to you. Up to you guys. If you guys are comfortable, that's fine. Atheists usually deny the existence of evil. Reason being, if you accept the existence of evil, you've got to define it. What is it? And the most agreed upon definition of evil, it's the corruption, perversion of that which is good. So if evil objectively exists, then good, some objective good, it must exist. And if there's an evil, a standard of what is good and what is evil, standing objectively above all men, then you've got to have a good being existing above all men. So that's why C.S. Lewis, who used to argue against God's existence from evil, after he became a Christian, he realized that the argument from evil actually backfires into a good, solid argument for God's existence. Point number 9 in the Christian response, point number 8 was atheists usually deny the existence of evil. Point number 9, God will defeat evil. God will defeat evil through Christ's death, resurrection, and return. God will defeat evil through Christ's death, resurrection, and return. So God is in the process. In all good God wants to destroy evil. An all-powerful God is able to destroy evil. Evil is not yet destroyed. It still exists. Therefore, the conclusion that actually follows from the premises from the problem of evil is that an all-good and all-powerful God will someday defeat evil. And God will defeat evil through Christ's death, resurrection, and return. And point number 10, the God of the Bible is the only guarantee that evil will ultimately be defeated. Let me repeat that. The God of the Bible is the only guarantee that evil will ultimately be defeated. Most people on earth live an optimistic life. They live like there's hope that evil will be defeated. Well, the God of the Bible is the only guarantee that evil will ultimately be defeated. Therefore, I think we can argue that all men that live optimistic lives actually live as if the Bible is true and live as if Christianity is true. Well, that's the problem of evil and the Christian response to it. Now, what we've... Then it runs to the next page. There's one more point. What we've covered thus far in our lectures is the different worldviews, and we gave some reasons why they're false and why the theistic worldview is correct. We've given arguments in defense of theism, in defense of the God of the Bible, and we've refuted the problem of evil. Now we're going to begin to talk about God's nature, and then we'll be going into a few lectures on the argument for the Trinity. So that's the end of this lecture here, lecture number 3.